You're listening to the Law of Attraction Radio Network.
Welcome to Quantum Leap Book Club. During the next hour, beloved mind scientist Parisha and her guests from around the world will read and discuss various best-selling books with well-known authors. Every show will apply retention techniques designed to help you to absorb powerful knowledge to effectively change your life. Join us every week for a thought-provoking hour and re-listen as often as you can. You will be delighted by what you learn, and you will be excited by the results. Are you ready to take the quantum leap? Here's Parisha.
Hello, you're with Quantum Leap Book Club. Parisha is currently teaching and traveling and won't be on the show today. Trina Cooper, a lifelong entrepreneur from Denver, Colorado, will be with us, as well as Marianne Love, a clinical psychologist based in Melbourne, Australia. Rosemary Heider from Frankfurt, Germany, a teacher of English, especially with young children. And Dr. Joyce Mollenhauer, doctor of naturopathy. And myself, Geraldine Darby-Ball, biologist and ecologist, joining us today as we read Code to Joy. And what we'll be looking at is Chapter 2, The Seven Limiting Beliefs. And indeed, it's a fascinating section today, and we start really straight in with the chapter looking at fear. And the great thing about this book is it gives us lots of case studies so that we can find that which we relate to or look at it in our life. And here there's the example of a very lovely man. Everyone says he's super nice, and he has this strange condition, which is the ability as a pilot to do anything. He's totally in cause, wonderful pilot. Yet when he's on the ground, he's overcome by a fear where it's almost like, as they say, he hits the floor. He gets down low. There's a fear, an absolute fear, that totally changes his behavior. One could describe that as irrational. What we really look at is how can you have two completely different behaviors? And as it says, the flying is like a floodlight that chases away the fears. But what we're really looking at behind this is different parts of the brain that are in use or being triggered in each one. When he's flying, he's in cause. He has the ability to focus and the ability to run through a sequence of actions, and that's running through a sequence of neural networks. And a neural network is where you have nerves in the brain, cells. So you have information highways created in the brain connected to each other. And there might be a particular set of information connecting certain nerves. And then another set of information will be another lot of nerves. And these cells connecting together, creating the information pathways, are what's totally firing when he's completely present and flying. Yet, as it says, when he's not flying, he's basically a mess. It shares with us that there's a childhood of being beaten, of being very, very harshly treated. When he's not flying, it's the other part of the brain, let's say the primitive part of the brain, that stored this intense emotion of trauma. And that's the part that takes over at those other times. So it's not a rational thing. And he shares that. He knows it's not rational to be so afraid at these other times. And it's as they say, it's these threads that run our lives. The wonderful thing is, though, you don't have to be stuck in those, which is why the book gives us the four-step process. And the brain research as well shows, unlike what, you know, unlike the old belief that you're stuck with your brain and once you've got those brain cells, that's all you've got. I mean, you might hear people used to say, oh, you know, you drunk lots of alcohol, you've killed your brain cells, you're done. But in reality, there's a thing called neurogenesis. So that's the neuron. Genesis means to grow. So you can continuously grow new neurons. They may be slower than other cells, but they can absolutely continue to grow. Then there's neuroplasticity. These are those brain cells having the ability to change, to be plastic. There's the sharing that our thoughts are like water. The more we think, it's like a little creek that started to make a line in the damp soil. And as that water comes through the damp soil, it starts to make a channel. The more we have that thought, is like the more we run water down there. And we absolutely know the power of water with magnificent places on our earth, like the Grand Canyon, and in Sydney we have a beautiful valley through the Blue Mountains and so many other places. We see that a continuous thought creates a massive outcome. So that neuroplasticity means we have the ability to change the course of the water. And what does that mean? We have the ability to change the firing, that's the electrical impulses, down that particular thought pattern. And when we stop firing it, plastic means we can change it. So that's how the four-step process assists. There's that ability to jump in here and assist. So no longer does he have to hit the floor and be very afraid when he's not flying. We go through that again and say, you know, any traumatic event that has increased emotions starts to create that channel. Now, you can use this positively. For example, when you're learning, I know there's a lot of students who are working from home at the moment, and in traditional ones like the Aboriginal community, the traditional teaching would be to sing it, dance it, paint it, tell the stories. That sort of thing has a whole lot of emotion involved and fires a lot of neurons. A wonderful way to learn. Sitting in front of a teacher just hearing the voice isn't very highly emotional. There's not a lot of neuron connection. So positively, if you really want to remember something, add a big emotion to it. You can probably recall really happy times the same as traumatic times. So the bigger the emotion, so not just trauma, but any happy, sad, the bigger the memory. Then what happens is when you repeat that particular emotion, as we're saying, it's like water gouging in, it gets bigger and bigger. Now, is there the ability to change it? Absolutely. But it's that consciousness needing to step in, because they say as plants move towards the sun, and you'll know that if you've got pot plants and you'll see them growing towards the light, our neurons are like that as well. They move towards the most emotionally charged thoughts. So that can then create habits, because then we get used to that and our body gets used to that and our body wants that. So this is the point where through consciousness we can step in and notice beliefs. And he shows us the seven limiting beliefs. We can notice these, like I'm not safe, I'm worthless, I'm powerless, I'm not lovable, I can't trust anyone, I'm bad, I'm alone. All of these, those seven beliefs there, seven limiting beliefs, can be to various extents through one's threads of life, as it says. So this is the ability to see that, hey, my sunshine is not this message that says I'm powerless. So I now have to, like the pot plant would have to move away from the sun, not that we want it to, our thoughts need to move away from those thoughts of powerless. So first identify it. Then actively notice it when it comes up and move away. And as it goes through the four steps, which we'll get through more today, there is processes specifically to assist that, moving away from those seven limiting beliefs. Another example is, you know, not safe. I read this. I recall having quite a few debates when my daughter was young. They're now 15 and 17. I remember people telling me that I should do controlled crying. And that's where if they weren't sleeping, put them in a room by themselves and just let them cry. Now, I'm not judging anyone who does that or feels that helps them, give the mum a break, whatever it is. For me personally, it didn't work in my mindset. And when I was going through this again, I was thinking, okay, that could actually set up quite a trauma, because if a young baby is crying, they could feel that they've been abandoned. They could feel that they're not safe. I was looking at these seven limiting beliefs. They could feel that they're powerless. There's nothing they could do. They could feel that they're alone, unlovable, unable to be trusted. You know, trust someone to be there with them. So for me, it was no, this young little growing human that is obviously very vulnerable when they're crying, they need to be with me or with someone else. So whether it's the front carry pack, or yes, if it's sleeping, you lie down and go to sleep close by. And that seemed to be a lot more of a normal way. And I appreciate early traveling showed me that that was what a lot of the world does. So that concept of controlled crying fitted in with that not safe belief. So, and as I mentioned, today we'll definitely go more into the four steps, but we look, sometimes you can't put your finger on the experience that's behind it. And maybe it's like a baby who's been left to cry a lot. That's not something necessarily they're going to say, oh, well, I remember when I was 3 weeks old that I was left, you know, in my cot alone for hours crying. So there again, there are processes to assist in uncovering, almost like onion layers. It could be somewhere where you feel you're not safe and you remember an incident. And when you get that, then you can look, oh, actually, there's one before. And so this allows us then to move through those beliefs. This first little bit does that, you know, I'm not being safe, and also being worthless, not being cared for. So great things today. And at this point, I'd love to hand over to any comments and the next part of what we're learning in Code to Joy.
Yes, I'd like to add to this, Geraldine. This is Rosemary from Germany. We have actually oftentimes, he's pointing out that we feel like we are failing or we are not meeting to some expectations. But in this case, when I have the core belief worthless, a situation where I failed can be more like an airstrike or like a real traumatic event. And he's sharing that client Richard, who just failed as an 8-year-old in school, and he wasn't able to really present something the teacher had asked him. He just got frozen. And so he had failed, and it's normal, and it's part of our learning process to do that. But for Richard decided, I am a failure. I am inadequate. I am not good enough. So it became a belief, and just like Geraldine shared, a hardwired neural network in his brain. So even though he became a very successful speaker later in his life, this belief made it an agonizing experience. He couldn't even enjoy this success because at the core of his understanding, he was still feeling very inadequate. And that sense of inadequacy also has very different variations. Like one of the variations the author is sharing is that I'm not good enough. I can't dance. I cannot do math very well. They are not based on facts. It just comes from the core belief, and it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Also, in regards of fear of failure and fear of success, he explains it very nicely. If you have a core belief of fear of failure, I am a failure, I better don't succeed, as I might not meet the expectation that follows. So I don't stand up, I don't show up, and I don't even start a project. And I could see myself sometimes in that. And when I journaled this core belief, I'm worthless, I also came up with that big variation, not good enough, and that I have to be perfect. And that's also someone he lists too. And that was very clear for me that when you are not having a sense of not feeling good enough, you work even harder. And I try to prove myself. I try to be working against the critical voices in my head. A lot of people maybe also have that core belief, might be feeling also driven by the need to do everything perfect. And it's also driven again by that core belief. And the author points also out that the main cause of this could be that you have a lot of criticism in your childhood, that maybe a parent or a significant person has been very critical to you, and you cannot meet their expectations. And one of the statements he makes, which is very powerful too, to look at this, is that you might feel like, maybe the person might feel like a disappointment, not only to other people, but this is disappointment for themselves. I like that he lists at the end the various statements and variations of the core belief worthless, and he's asking each reader, and that has been very helpful for me, to look at this for a moment and see which one really speaks to you, which one resonates with you. Another core belief from the seven beliefs is I'm powerless. And here's we have a person called Carmen, and she's really not feeling strong enough to take care of herself. That's what she's saying. And then he's also explaining about Michael, who is actually turning up as a wimp in his marriage and suddenly has no confidence and is resigning to a mediocre life. To be powerless means that you do not have the action or the power or the inner strength inside to make an impact, to really assert yourself, to move into action. That is often by Michael, for example, it has been that he was not seen by his parents. And I remember when many years ago, I was in a workshop and we did an exercise where we were actually seen. Many of us have not been seen, and I can remember relate to that because the parents had to address many other issues in their life, maybe disasters or family problems or economic problems. And so it could be, and that happens in Michael's case, he decided, I don't matter. I'm invisible. Nobody cares about me. So when he married, that core belief activated again. Also in this case, I'm powerless, other people pick that up and they have clues and they feel that you feel invisible. And what happens is sometimes you don't get heard. And I remember that I had that a lot in my early teenager years. You don't get heard. Nobody listens to you. Nobody cares about your opinion because they pick up your clues. I'm invisible. I don't matter. And other variations he's listing also of powerless is that I'm helpless, I'm weak, I'm trapped, and I cannot stand up for myself. And the fourth one from the seven core beliefs he's exploring is the belief that I'm not lovable. A person called Heather was completely falling apart when her boyfriend ended up her relationship on the phone. And that was not only because of that. She was also really falling apart because she had that deep sense of I'm not lovable. And I think I'm passing it on to the next speaker to share about that.
Absolutely. Hi, that's a great one. And we saw Trina.
Hi there. Yeah, this is Trina in Denver. And I've got to say before I start sharing a little bit in the chapter, how important it is to recognize as you're reading some of these may be little thoughts that roll through your head sometimes. And what we're talking about here is really looking at how we get triggered now as an adult, even though we don't know why. And sometimes the thoughts come up right away. So that's, I'm really loving this book because it's giving us the little clues in the sentences. But I'm finding as I'm reading, I may read a sentence and all of a sudden I start feeling the emotion come up and then what thoughts are following it. So I'm going to talk about a couple of these belief systems. I'm going to pick up with I'm not lovable and talk a little bit about I cannot trust anyone and then start into I am bad. So let's talk about I'm not lovable. Rosemary was just talking about Heather. And so Heather's reaction after her boyfriend broke up with her, she was really triggered and she had no idea why. Well, as they went back and started taking a look at what was going on with her, they found out that both parents worked, the father was hardly ever present, and the grandfather died when she was five. And the belief that she took on really was, I'm just unlovable. Everybody leaves. Everybody's not here. They don't really love me. It wasn't that I'm not feeling loved. It was a deep core of I'm not lovable. So compared to the idea of I am safe, which kind of gives us this secure foundation to go out in the world and explore, this idea of I'm not lovable rocks us at our soul. It completely shocks us emotionally. So we go just completely off kilter. This particular one deals with our emotional bedrock. If you are loved, then this gives you the whole bedrock for growth as a person. So our parents then, a lot of this one particularly stems from our parents or our guardians not being available to us when we're young. Not present. They don't even have to be doing anything that's abusive or things like that. They're just not present. And so the child picks that up is they don't love me. I'm unlovable. They don't love me. And so it has a devastating impact as they get older. They also shared a little bit of some other examples, but all of these, because of the impact that they had when they were young, triggered when they got older. They couldn't let go, like Ruby couldn't go into forgiveness with her husband when he had an affair, even though it happened years ago. Little things, little words like beauty or attraction or secret would just send her spinning. One of the things that he points out about this is that the I'm not lovable belief most often goes back and triggers something from long ago. So in her case, the way her thought went, and I'm going to read this, the emotional logic that went with her when she found out about this, or she'd hear these words of betrayal, the fact was that he was cheating behind her back meant she wasn't lovable and never was. And for a while, even though she thought she was wrong. So even if he says he loves her now, he must be lying. So our mind plays these games and makes everything very logical based on this old core belief system. Then the next one, and there are different sentences for this one, like, I don't deserve love, I have no identity, I don't deserve to have a loving relationship. All of those kind of thought processes might pop up with us. And one of the key points about this is, even though the people know logically that the thoughts aren't necessarily making sense, it's not enough to change them. They have to go through some kind of process. And of course, they bring the four steps forward. I cannot trust anyone is something that's in a way similar. They grow up in emotionally cold environments. Maybe in this case, though, the parents leave. They're gone. Or the person that's their caretaker leaves. And so they feel betrayed. In Tom's case, it was, the people I love leave. So he didn't want to get so emotionally attached and loving somebody, because if he did, that person would leave, and it caused all kinds of stress in his life. Most of the people who can't trust are always on guard. They're afraid. They're suspicious. They're ill at ease. They're the backseat drivers. They want to be in control because they have the fear in the background as well. So two sources of this belief are the key authority figures in our early lives, especially our parents, the experiences again with them. And second, these small incremental disappointments that can happen in our life over and over and over again. Doesn't have to be big. It can be the little micro traumas that build. So some of these that go with this is, I can't believe anything that anyone tells me. I don't trust anyone in authority. I'm not a trusting person. I can't be trusted. I'm bad luck. Those kinds of feelings come out with this one. And the last one I'm going to move into really quickly is I am bad, which really has to do with self-sabotage. And we're going to begin talking about Claudia. And Claudia's problem is, she's very bright, very talented, but no matter what she does, she sabotages the relationship. So she can't keep clients, and she just gets in her own way all the time. So she had a divorced mother, saw her father very rarely, again, going back to those parents. But the mother was critical. She literally came home from school one day, and her mom had moved out. It was empty. The whole place was empty. And her little sister was gone. And all their stuff was gone, even the furniture. So I'm going to leave that with the next co-host to let you know how that moves on.
Yes. We get to Mary Ann.
I know, I didn't want to leave people too long on the edge of the cliff.
Yeah, so really interesting story, and amazing that Claudia is actually as successful, really, as she is. But like she said, that she finds herself really self-sabotaging. And it's sort of like when she gets on the brink of success, then she'll really wipe out those relationships. And it makes sense when you find out that one day when Claudia came home from school, her mother and her whole family had moved out of the house, taken everything, the furniture, her sister, everything, and left the place empty, with no word to Claudia. She had no idea where anybody had went, and they obviously didn't take her with them. So you can imagine that would be quite damaging and overwhelming to a person. But anyway, Claudia ended up staying with a relative and managed to track down her mum and and surprisingly, in a way, went back to live with her, and then eventually left again. She was obviously quite bright and insightful and things, because she managed to make quite a good life for herself, and yet because of this underlying feeling she's bad, she kept sabotaging herself and wouldn't allow success, which kind of makes sense that a thought like I'm bad might be programmed in the subconscious when you're dealing with a situation where you're left behind to that degree. And, you know, it's really, so they bring up some really interesting points here, and I think, you know, it's important as parents to be kind to yourself, because you've been parented yourself, so a lot of things that you were raised with is then programmed and becomes habitual language until it becomes conscious and explored. So a lot of things I think we pass on to our children are habitual in as much as they were done to us, and we haven't really looked at it consciously to see how it's being passed on. And it's also just cultural. Sometimes these things just seem normal in our culture. But one of the things they point out with the I'm bad negative belief is sometimes parents can use the child has like an innate need for approval, and this can be really helpful. It helps them learn and helps them be guided by their parents. And they really want to please, like ultimately. I know parents with teenagers might not feel that way sometimes, but, you know, fundamentally kids want to please, and parents can really, in a way, overuse that vulnerability in a child by condemning them. And if you use condemnation, maybe a kid will do what you say, and use that strategy a bit too much, and it can cause harm. It can cause a child to believe that they're fundamentally bad. If you're using a bit more instruction for the kid, then they can learn without internalizing a really negative image of themselves. And a good example of that is, you know, just something as simple as, you know, the kid spills the milk, and you could say to them, well, what's the matter with you? Or you could say to them, hey, look, you just get some paper towel and wipe it up, it'll be okay. And one way will leave them feeling like shame, which is sort of feeling a sense that there's something fundamentally wrong with them as a person. And the other way will just make them feel potentially okay, not embarrassed, maybe embarrassed, where they'll feel like, oh, they, you know, did something wrong, but there's a way to recover from it. And if the nervous system doesn't get overwhelmed, and if there's a way out where they can still keep their sense of identity, then they won't be programming in these sort of global negative statements about the self, because as soon as you create a big I statement like that, I am bad, then you're making a general statement, then that almost becomes the lens that you look out into the world with, and so you'll apply it everywhere. So Claudia applied it to her work, and it becomes self-fulfilling because you almost have to live your belief over everything else, so you'll have to create it. If I'm bad there, then you're going to have to create a circumstance where you'll seek out guilt so that you can get to punish yourself. And I had a client yesterday who was discussing, you know, why did he do a certain behaviour? It was around sexuality and, you know, looking at women and, you know, wanting to be with different women, even if you have a partner and those sort of things. And, you know, even though that's an innate drive in the human being, the drive to actually act it out? And we explored this idea about the addiction to self-sabotage, addiction to guilt and disliking the self. You know, what's the feeling that comes after that is actually the thing to look at? So if you eat too much, what's the feeling that comes after? And is it guilt? Then actually then the feeling of guilt has an underlying belief. So we keep creating these scenarios so that we get to keep living our underlying truths, and we like to prove ourselves right. Like, we like our worldview to stay consistent. So unfortunately, if that's a negative belief, then we're going to keep living that and recreating circumstances, picking nasty partners, doing all sorts of dramas in order to recreate these underlying beliefs. So it's awesome that there's a way out of this just through, you know, their four-step process and becoming conscious of what's there. Like, nothing holds us back once you get into that unconscious programming, a bit like a virus on a computer. You know, once you, you know, put the new program in and start to unravel the old, you're free. So So some things, like, I think it's really helpful to look at some of the underlying beliefs that could go with I'm bad, like I'm wrong or I'm no good, I'm terrible, I'm shameful, I'm sinful, I cause misfortune. So he's given some really good examples that a lot of people, I'm sure, could identify if you look through the book, to find the particular negative belief that is holding you back. And another one that they spoke about here, which I think a lot of people can identify with, which is the belief I'm alone. And he gave some really interesting examples. I work quite a bit with veterans, and my heart really goes out to them. There's this pain that's almost unreachable that sits within the being of a veteran, I think, and there's this disconnect. I see this sort of empty disconnect that can happen for veterans due to the training and the life and the traumas that happen while in service. And it's really nice to hear that there's a way back. And he gave a story of Gabe, who was in the military. He was actually a sniper in the military. And before that, he had pretty rough upbringing, raised by a family relative who was into drugs and things. And one day, even himself picked up a gun out of curiosity and accidentally shot another kid and killed them. So imagine Gabe had some pretty big storylines that would affect his sense of connection to the world. And again, Nathan, who lost his daughter in an accident. And it was interesting with Nathan that it wasn't necessarily the loss of his daughter. It was the fact that when he was in the accident, he was sitting there and they were both crushed by the pressure of the steering wheel and things that had smashed in on them. And he had to sit and he couldn't move himself. There was nothing he could do to save his daughter, and he had to listen to her die. And that futility had left him with a sense of disconnection and I'm alone. And, you know, and it makes sense once you've gone through something, a big loss like that, that you might be blaming yourself or you might be blaming God, or, you know, just a sense of, you know, despair and hopelessness that can happen. And even if you logically understand what happened and how it happened and how it wasn't your fault and all of that, some levels that cannot make any difference at all when we're talking about subconscious programming and anger at the self. So I think it's really helpful to look at, you know, if you're feeling a sense of disconnection, what might be underlying that is a disconnection to yourself. And it's good to also understand what is connection. And you think, well, people with connection might be connected to nature, they connect to trees, they connect to spirituality, they might connect to music, art, they might connect to other people, the human family at large. And so if you don't have any of those sense of connections, it doesn't even have to be to a God as such, but just to your world and your place in it, then you may be living with this I'm alone experience, which then can very much impact your immune system, sense of well-being in the world. So some of the thoughts that go with I'm alone is life is empty, there's no point, no point to anything, I'm disconnected from the world, I'm disconnected from God, I'm angry at God and I'm angry at myself. So, you know, on a happy note, Gabe went really well. He was a military guy. He actually really recovered fast, and so did Nathan, who whose daughter was killed. So it's all powerful, very, very powerful stuff. And I know in my work, I do this sort of work often. I use EMDR therapy for it, and I see amazing results once you can lift some of this unconscious programming. It's so doable. A couple of sessions sometimes gets it done. So definitely worth looking at these underlying beliefs.
It certainly is. And as you said there, there's the thing where people can logically say, I understand or I see or I know that a better behaviour would be this one. And then there's, it happens anyway. That's the common theme throughout it all. And we understand from brain research, there's a lot of reasons why. So to be able to look at that and then get these skills, which really helps. That's why I so suggest people grab this book. You know, it's, the code to joy really is about that, because there is a science behind this. And as Marianne, as you shared, you know, from your absolute clinical perspective, you see it daily with people. There's often that it's not logically, I know, but so let's use these four-step process to find the but, find the part where it's as you said, the micro trauma or the bigger trauma or the childhood trauma? And also, how do we have compassion for ourselves and compassion for other people, understanding that everyone's got, as they call it in the book, these threads that run our lives. Let's let these threads go and move forward. And with that, I'd love to have Dr. Joyce Mollenhauer join us.
Yes. I'm going to pick up on you talking about threads. I have always been intrigued with beautiful tapestries. And you see on one side of it absolute perfection, a gorgeous scene or a person that's well, the features are all visible. Then you turn that tapestry on the other side and you see what looks like total chaos. So I've always really appreciated that as an example of us as human beings. It takes a lot of those threads to create how we live and how we react to living. And I think it's an extremely common experience that people have that they go in. We can have moments when we think there's not a single person in this world that understands me and I don't understand myself. So these two authors have pulled together a whole structure that helps us unravel some of those threads so that we can look like that perfected picture on the beautiful side and try to understand what all those threads were on the back. And certainly when you do the exercise in chapter one of identifying some of the significant experiences in your life, that's a start for you getting the triggers that help you with this, because as we've discussed, a whole lot of these people's experiences have not been obvious. Certainly Claudia, who came home to an empty house and her mother had left her, that's obvious. But there are also, they're including the situations where you don't experience it yourself. It happens to someone else. Well, I don't think I would really have put thought to the fact that I've been affected by my friend's parents divorcing or some of the examples they give here. So these are things that we can get uncover them while we work through this, because they've given us all these different examples. And maybe the example they give isn't right on for you, but it triggers what is right on for you. So I think it's very valuable to read down the last part of this chapter. Definitely gives you a chance to actually check off which ones do really speak to you. Like, are you a person that avoids conflicts? And that's a common thing with many people. And if you're not feeling safe, then you're not going to be very inclined to explore your world. So that's all pretty logical. Fear of failing is pretty much a common thing in schools just because of the past way that they taught things. People with the high marks got acknowledged and the people with the low marks were kind of ignored. So I don't think there'd be anyone reading through this and paying attention to their own reactions that wouldn't get a great amount of help in getting to understand themselves. And then it doesn't really matter if someone else understands you or not, because you can explain yourself in a much more logical way. So it's a worthwhile book, and I certainly encourage all of us to pay attention to the process.
I think it couldn't be said better, Joyce, as a rounding it up. Everybody, even if you're totally feeling you've got everything handled, there's a way of really appreciating other people then. So none of us are an island. So I've had this information, but it's reading it again, seeing it again, that particular day I read it, then a particular conversation is had, or as a mum, you know, looking at the two young people that I'm living with and seeing how they react to things. And we had a funny conversation the other day because I know that their births got filmed, and they were on very old tapes, of course. So they were talking about getting them converted to something that could be watched today. Neither of them want to see it, of course. They think that's just crazy, horrible. No, thank you. However, part of my mind was like, I wonder what was happening in that time, because I don't recall a lot of it consciously. or whether it's the pain or whatever it is, that at that time that memory part of the brain shuts down and the part of the brain, our survival part of the brain, picks up and takes over. So, yeah, as Joyce said there, sometimes we remember it clearly, sometimes it's more subtle, and that subtlety can be that there was so much trauma, pain, or drugs that the recording of that information went into a different part of the brain, the more primitive part, the survival part, because the thinking part of the brain or the analytical brain, the our big frontal lobes that are so much into working things out, is shut down when we're in those situations. As we go through the processes, as we mentioned, it's like onion skins. You may not get to that absolute root experience because that could still be in the primitive part and not revealing itself yet. But as you undo the layers, you get closer. And when you get that, there's an aha moment. And you'll see from Dr. Joe Dispenza's work and others, they actually use the machinery to show what's going on in the brain in one of those aha moments. It refiles information. It comes out of that primitive part and then filed in the thinking part. So, for example, the person who was in the car with his daughter while she was dying, I wouldn't be surprised if a whole lot of that information went into the subconscious part of the brain. This will allow it to come out. I myself had a car accident, and I only remembered to the point where I had the accident. But going through this process, a particular process of getting it out of the part of the brain that was the survival part of the brain, I then was able to recall all the rest of the accident. And when that happened, I had a spontaneous healing of a nerve injury I'd had in my arm and up my shoulder for years. It was absolutely amazing that I had said a particular statement that my arm doesn't work when I was trying to write the other person's details down. And that statement had been lodged in that primitive part of my brain, the survival part, and had stayed there as a physical outcome. So whether it's a physical outcome or it's a particular belief, this is real, that we are not our body. We have these programs, and like a computer, there can be a bug. So, hey, we found the bug cleaner. Let's use it. And I definitely invite some comments from our team today.
Hi, this is Marianne. I just wanted to add to what you were saying there, Geraldine, is that in the nervous system, what I find with clients is once you can take the emotional charge off whatever is stored in the unconscious, and I think that's probably part of what happened in your situation, you got to the absolute moment where you made a decision that your arm's not working, or made a statement that would have been lodged in the brain like a decision. And with it, likely would have been a whole lot of charge that hadn't happened at the time of the accident. And I noticed once with the clients that I work with, once the charge, the emotional charge can be taken off any memory or any sense of large negative, you know, global kind of negative belief, then the re-scripting the belief becomes really easy, like it's almost done. Like actually through taking the emotional charge out of it, people begin to then see it from all sorts of other different angles and realize a whole lot of things like, oh, it wasn't my fault, my mum was going through this, that's why she did that, and it wasn't about me. And then so all this awareness can come through once the charge is off the situation. And it's not a hard thing to do then. It feels hard before while you're still carrying the charge, but once you're free of the charge and once this conscious awareness has happened, it's all easy. It's sort of a natural flow into letting go of what's just not true and doesn't serve.
Absolutely. I know Trina's got some comments on that too, and I just quickly want to, on that point, when the charge comes off, as you're saying, really important point, when that charge comes off, it also enables, because I notice this in myself and others, it also enables you to have more of your focus and your ability in the present moment, because while you've got charge on there, it also means that there's a little piece of you that's back in that incident of pain or suffering. So taking off the charge also makes you better memory, better able to confront things, better ability to take in the world around you. So many reasons for releasing the charge. And Trina.
Yeah, the comment I wanted to make is some of this is so subtle too, and you really literally don't link a behavior now in your present life to something that happened when you were younger. One thing that happened to me, I really had an aversion to writing and just could never get myself to sit down and write something. It was always a big drama thing. Never could understand what it was until I was actually going through a process with someone and they said, oh, give me, you know, tell me what you'd want to put down. And I couldn't think of anything, but the only thing that could pop up was this friend of mine. When we were in high school, in one of the classes, we had to write a journal. My friend, her parents found her journal. She had written about all these things. What does a teenage girl write about? Her parents got very upset with her and asked her to tell them all the people who had drank, used drugs, whatever. So she did. Well, her parents took the list, went to the police department, turned it in there, and all of our friends started getting arrested, pulled over, you know, for drinking or whatever it was. And some kids got in a whole lot of trouble. I never associated it with writing. But years ago, when I'm in this process, and I tell this person that, and they said, you know, go on, talk a little bit more. So I did, and I told them what happened to my friend, which she became an alcoholic. She got, when she got older and her daughter was about 12 years old, we stayed in touch. I had a 12-year-old daughter at the same time. My friend called me, talked to me for a little bit, made apologies and stuff. We set up a lunch to get together, and the next day she went out and she killed herself. And I was just like, wow, you know, it was, I didn't see it coming at that point in time, but this person said to me, wow, writing doesn't just hurt people, it kills people. And when she said that, it was like a gazillion fireworks went off in my body. I knew right at that instant that I created a fear of writing based on these progressions of incidences. And then what's really cool is a lot of times the universe shows up and says, here's your opportunity to show that you got over this. Within a week, I get a phone call that says, we would really like you to write a chapter in this book, this compilation book, but we need it by this date. And I could feel the resistance coming up. I sat down, but as soon as I started to write, it all flowed out onto the paper. They literally took my writing. They didn't edit anything. They said it was fabulous. And I had not written anything to give to somebody to read in probably 25 years. So these little subtle things are so important, and this book gives you an opportunity to unlock them. Anytime you find that resistance really pushing at you for something, it's worth giving it a look and seeing what it is, because what we're doing is shutting ourselves down instead of really living our life to the fullest. So I just really felt compelled to share that story because it was huge. And I think everybody has a huge story in there somewhere.
And that's such a powerful example. And as you said, everyone has a huge story. And as you also said, that huge story can come from very small beginnings. So again, it gives us the reason why whoever you are or wherever you're at, this book, The Code of Joy, that allows you to go through that process, at least starts taking off the charge, takes off those called the onion rings, allows you to get closer, gives you those aha moments. And I know Rosemary also has input on this.
Yes, I'd like to just add from the book the idea that he's saying, actually, the idea of the chapter we are discussing today is to identify your personal belief, and he has an assessment at the end where you can cross on certain statements related to each belief. And what he's saying is basically that it doesn't really matter if you're not sure, is this really my core belief I need to work on? He's saying that basically you are moving into the area of your brain that there's something wrong with me, and you are moving into changing that to there's something right with me. So even if you're not sure after this assessment, going through this assessment, you're not sure if this is really the core belief I want to work on, you are actually confronting the area, something is wrong with me. And I really like that part. And I agree that definitely that it cannot be handled unless the emotional charge is dissolved. And I think that will come up in the next chapters.
I love that. And I love that statement. There's something right with me. I think if I go around and say that today, that'll be good. I'll train the brain to find those things. So maybe that's what we could all do for the day. There's something right with me. And on that note, we'll close today's book call. So it is that time to conclude our studies, but we thank you for sharing your time and energy with us. You matter and count. You always make a difference.
Thank you for listening to Quantum Leap Book Club. For more information where you can contact us, go to loaradionetwork.com/quantum-leap. Have a great week.